accession number 268868, reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Max Gamble in his home Perth, Western Australia, on the 6th of the 1st, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Max, we've been talking about the importance of the plane and the importance of the pilot. You're mentioning, obviously, that the pilot was of more importance than the plane. How difficult was it to avoid the thought of crashing, avoid the thought of being in this precarious situation, given that some of your comrades might be falling by the wayside anyway?
Well, I think when one had got used to the danger element, there was always this danger of being shot down by either the Germans through their planes or through their AK-AK. So that when it came to the business of undercarriages not locking down, it was just a thing you accepted. That the powers that be had decided that the best thing for the pilots to conserve the pilot's life was if the undercarriage did not lock and you couldn't make it do so, go. Green lights came on for each wheel so that you knew that. If that didn't happen, you went along and bailed out.
So let's talk about your continuing duties.
Well, we were still at Voltano airstrip with the 8th Army held up at Monte Cassino and the Anzio landing having just begun a week or two before. There was one special trip I did at this time. The army at Anzio in the landing were worried about one special bit halfway between there and Rome. So they asked the PRU, which was the Photographic Reconnaissance Unit, to photograph this. And they refused. They said they'd be shot out of the sky, and they were using focal length cameras, which you normally did your photographing from about 36,000 feet. As they wouldn't do it, our squadron was told they had to do it, and I was the one with the most experience on vertical line overlap photography. I was sent out to do this, and my number two was the chap from Singapore, Charlie, whom I'd mentioned before. Well, I got out with quite a lot of AK-AK going, and it was rather an odd day in that the cloud base was about 20,000 feet. And I had to do the line overlap at 18,000 feet, which gave the gunners quite a good indication of where I was in height and so on. So I started this line overlap where the pilot had to keep flying absolutely level and straight. And gradually the AK-AK was getting closer and closer to me. And I was thinking, this is getting so close, I'm going to have to stop filming and start again. And suddenly the AK-AK stopped, and I couldn't understand what was going on. And the next moment, I was faced with a barrage of FW-190s, Focke-Wulf 190s, coming straight out of the cloud just in front of me. And there was a wild thing where they were swinging all directions, I was swinging other directions, and none of us got a shot at any of the others, but we just went straight through. They disappeared. So did my number two, Charlie. He decided he was going to have a Focke-Wulf, so he took off to the southern side of Italy, where he thought they would turn and go back. So I was left, having switched off the cameras, so I thought, right, I'll trick the gunners. So I went to the other end of the line that I was supposed to overlap and started filming from the other end. And I managed to get through most of it before the ack-ack started again. And so I managed to actually link up with what I'd done, but it had to be recorded that it had been done from both ends of the line overlap. So that was done, and successfully. It was the aerial shoots that I directed for the Army that the Navy must have been listening in on the radio, and they picked this up, and they contacted the Air Force and said, could the Air Force direct shoots from one of their cruisers, which turned out to be HMS Mauritius. So this was arranged, and I went out and gave them the usual procedure. All I could do was tell them over the air what to do. So I said, right, first shot, try and put on this spot. Well, the first shot came in, and I told them to add, I think it was something like 600 yards. Well, they did it the wrong way, so I doubled up. And then they got the hang of things. And what we did was mark the target with just single shots. And once they had recorded the target, we then went on to another target, and they then at night bombarded those targets. And they were very successful. They're usually ammo dumps. They were very successful, and they were delighted with this. So I did several with the Navy, and then I told them that I was finishing my tour and that it'd have to be somebody else coming on. And so the next one was my last one. They said, right, this was over the radio, we'd like you to be a guest of the Navy for 3 weeks, which meant going on the HMS Mauritius until it came back in again to Naples for refueling. Well, by that time I was finished my tour, and the Air Force said, no, we won't allow you to go do that. You're wanted as an instructor back in Palestine.
What was the feeling like to know that you'd finished your tour? You'd gotten through safely?
A pretty big relief, as you can imagine. An interesting offshoot from this. During all this time we're flying round the Naples area, Vesuvius had been blowing up on bursts every now and then, and at night if you were near it was very spectacular. So when we'd finished the tour, my friend Charlie Edmondson, he finished at the same time. We had the usual party, and then we got on the train in the evening to go to Taranto in southern Italy to pick up a troop ship to take us to Alexandria. This was overnight journey and the next day. When we waked up in the morning, everything was white. Not by snow, but it was ash. Vesuvius had blown up completely. There was a very big eruption at that time. And it really was quite bad. A lot of ash all over the countryside. And the time we could see, we were probably 50, 60 miles from the from the volcano itself. So then we managed to get on the troop ship at Taranto and travel to Alexandria went to a transit camp, and Charlie went to one OTU, and I was sent to the OTU, I can't remember the number, at Petah Tikva, just outside Tel Aviv in Palestine. So from here on starts a different setup as an instructor.
You were going to tell us about the importance of strafing. What was associated with strafing, trains, whatever. And you had a certain experience that you were going to share with us, I understood.
Well, can I leave that until I'm on the Mustang Squadron, where it was strafing every day, virtually. At the OTU, the main thing was checking all the pilots coming through, checking their ability with aerobatics, their general flying, and then there was air-to-air gunnery, where the instructor took off with a plane, a Hurricane, with a drogue attached to it. A drogue was something rather like a big windsock. Taking off with those was a bit dramatic, because you had to
fly vertically and then
fly. You had to go along the runway until you struck 85 miles per hour, go straight up, and then level off at about 50 feet, and that lifted the drogue.
You mentioned some of that earlier.
Yes.
What was it like to be instructing rather than actually flying yourself?
Well, you still were flying yourself.
But not on operation, presumably.
But not on operations. Some of the instruction was in the two-seaters in the Harvards. Flying from the back seat with the other person in the front seat. That was the general checking of their flying ability. But with the air-to-air gunnery, you had to fly the towing aircraft and at the same time observe how well the pilots did on putting live ammunition through the drogue.
What was your impression of the quality of the up-and-coming chaps at this point?
Some were rather poor. They improved rather quickly, but to begin with, they were a bit clueless on some of these things. I had one chap who was so intent on getting on this drogue that as he came in from a quarter and gradually got around until he was line astern, I was shouting at him to break off, because shooting at the drogue, he was shooting at me. And all I could do was sit in behind the armour plating, behind my back. This chap went right through the drogue until it was wrapped over the wing of his plane. Now, there was no way to know what had happened to the wire. Did I have the wire on, or did he have the wire dangling from his plane with the drogue well wrapped round the wing? So I came back over the airfield control tower, told them what was happening, and asked if they could see the wire. Well, they came over and said, "You're all clear, you haven't got the wire on. Clear to land." So I came in, and then all hell was let loose, because the people could hear their wire swishing. And we used to call them starter racks, which are really great starter batteries, with batteries 3/4 of almost a yard long, two in a little wheelbarrow type of thing. Well, the wire grabbed round one of this, and it went about 100 feet in the air, and unfortunately it didn't crash any other aircraft, and I landed with the wire on. we also had to instruct a little bit on air-to-ground gunnery. Not very much of that, and a small amount of dive bombing. The dive bombing, there was very little really in the syllabus. The other thing I did was take a Spitfire from the field up to Damascus in Syria, and half a dozen pilots came up in three Harvards to Syria. The idea was to give them training in controlling army air-controlled chutes, because the army had the artillery based in Damascus. So I used to go up for a week there, usually until I trained all six. Had one interesting thing on the way up. The plane got rougher and rougher, so I started checking magnetos, carburation, the revs and so on, and there was no way I could alter it. And I was frightened that the vibration would eventually break the engine out of the engine bearers. And there was no servicing of any sort up there, so I had to get a couple of the chaps to help me, and we took off the rocker covers and found that the valve tappets had been left unscrewed. So when we set them at roughly the right amount, because we didn't quite know what it was, just by feel, the engine was all right again. We also taught the chaps real low flying on some of the maize fields, right down until you were virtually touching the tops of the maize. This was because at times your own life depended on getting really low, as will come up when we go on to the next squadron. And the other thing we had to teach them was that if they got into a dogfight of sort, you didn't really do accurate flying. You did anything but that, so that it put off whoever was shooting at you.
What was the most important thing that you needed to instill in the new recruits, do you feel?
Well, this was for real. Wrong mistake and you're a goner. And quick reaction, and try to outthink the other people, whether it happened to be the gunners on the ground or somebody in an aircraft. There were all sorts of things, various manoeuvres and so on, and defensive circles and this sort of thing, but that was fairly much to the book.
What about things that you could only learn from experience?
Well, I think only learn from experience was what happened when you were first shot at by either from another aircraft or from the ground. Even though you'd been told about it, it gave you quite a fairly distinct shock, and you had to get on with it and try and outthink the gunner, which was in most cases, in either case, altering direction and height and predictability. No set one turn after the other, otherwise they would see the pattern and make their adjustment for that. So everything had to be pretty irregular. And if somebody was on your tail and so on, you didn't do that. Just had to try and do the unexpected, even to the extent of doing a spin if he couldn't quite shoot at you, because it meant that you suddenly altered your speed so much that he'd overshoot you.
Were there other pilots that you knew would never make it?
Not quite, but you thought that their chances might have been a bit slim. Put it that way.
Were you able to tell them that?
Well, in more or less those words, yes. That if they didn't sort of smarten up a little bit, that they'd be a bit of a sitting duck.
How are you looked at from the recruit's point of view, do you think?
Most of the recruits were very good. You got the odd one who was a bit of a know-all and so on, who was usually just a pain in the bloody neck. Had one course, and they were all Polish people. Now, there was quite a lot of Poles in the RAF. Now, when these fellows were in training, because I was in training with them a year or two before, normally all other flying on the station was stopped when the Poles were flying, because they were pretty unpredictable and, to put it bluntly, split us. So when I had a group of them come in for the training at OTU, I had them in the lecture room first to ask them what were their main current aims in life. And they all said they wanted to knock off the Nazis. So I said, right, if this is the case, I want you to be sensible in your flying, because if you're not, it'll mean we lose a pilot, and more so, we lose an aircraft, which is needed for training. And din that into them, and give them their due. They perform well, there were no accidents, they pass well, and they put on a tremendous party when they were finished. I think I was probably the main guest.
Why?
I think because of being tough at them and straight. They preferred that sort of rather harsh treatment.
How long would the course last?
Took them about 3 weeks.
So from where to go, what would you begin by teaching them?
Well, the first thing you took them up and was in a Harvard and just checked the general flying. And then spins, see how they went into a spin, recovered from a spin, their various aerobatic manoeuvres, see how they went. And from there he went on to the other ones and the course that I mentioned.
How long would you be on instruction duties for, or instructor duties for?
Normal course of events, the idea was that you had 6 months away from operational flying.
In that time, what were you to hear of the direction the war was taking and what was going on in the outside world of the war?
Just major events. As far as the Russian front was concerned, absolutely nothing. Events like D-Day, of course, were broadcast.
Mm.
But not much more.
Well, you've been speaking, obviously, about your involvement with reconnaissance for a particular scenario, an operation, and you were mentioning the Gustav Line south of Rome. May the 11th, Allies attacked the Gustav Line south of Rome. Had you heard, for instance, how the Russians were beginning to fare?
No. The Russians, we heard nothing. We just didn't know.
So you mentioned, obviously, the D-Day landings of June the 6th. What was it like to know, finally, things are really starting to look more positive? You're in the south and the west now.
Well, actually, when we heard that news, I just was being flown back from an airfield where it had a crash. I was sent to do an instructor's course in the Arabian side of near Suez. And we had a temporary airfield on the eastern side of the Suez Canal. And on taking off from there with this instructor, at about 50 feet, the engine just suddenly cut. There was no warning, just a complete cut. And all that ahead of us was sandhills. So it was a very sudden boom, boom, boom. Control forward as far as we go, back as far as we go, boom, into the sand, and stopped in about 20 feet from about 90 miles an hour. And my neck took a bit of stretching. I've had trouble with it since. So I just got back from being flown back after that crash to the station I was on near Suez, and we heard the news that the Allies had landed in Normandy.
What did that mean for you?
Well, it meant that getting towards what we'd been hoping for a long time, the end of the war, the end of the Nazis.
Were you eager to get back involved, given the fact that you were safe training?
Yes, most of us were. After being away from operational flying for about 4 months or so, most of us were eager to get back. And at that time, there was a notice put on the notice board that the Navy required pilots with one operational tour on Spitfires urgently. So I applied and got a reply back to say that I had everything they required plus, but they had no Australians, so they thought perhaps I'd be lonely. So I was turned down, and a couple of weeks after that there was another notice came up which was very urgent for experienced pilots and single-engine aircraft. So I applied, and everything happened very, very quickly. Just said, right, you're finishing here, get to Egypt. Went across to the training transit camp at Al-Mazar in Egypt, and was flown to Italy, to Foggia. And then, by this time, didn't know where I was going, got on a train, which was a goods train, with a little caboose. And in the caboose found another pilot, an RAF chap, we were both going in the same squadron. He turned out to be the CO of the squadron a short while later, and I became the senior flight commander some time later.
In relation to training others, what were you telling them about things like bailing out, what you should do if the plane is about to crash?
Well, at that time, I'd only had experience. Experience on Hurricanes and Spitfires, and so I only knew about that. Yes, we told them that normally it was fine.
Were you to give them advice in case of being captured?
Most of that had been done before.
Were you able to give them any advice at all on what they might expect if they were captured, or how they should behave?
A lot of this had been dealt with in their training, so that it was just a follow on from those from that. We did give what advice we could, but you didn't really have much advice if you hadn't been through it yourself.